this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Tracking Andy's Journey. Once ranked number 37 in world tennis, Raleigh's Andy Andrews charts an ambitious plan for his real estate projects. And that's on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Front Row Seat for the Action. Son of a well-known local businessman, the 56-year-old Andy Andrews is determined to leave a mark on Raleigh with his projects. And this article was written by Amanda Hoyle. At the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center and home of the United States Tennis Association's U.S. Open in Flushing Meadows, New York, the superstructure of steel supporting the new retractable roof over Arthur Ashe Stadium is complete and expected to be fully operational for the 2016 tournament. It's part of a $500 million privately funded project by the USTA to boost fan and player participation at one of the largest stages in the world for professional and amateur tennis, a sport that's so far outlasting golf and every other sport in interest level and long-term participation rates. A few years ago, when construction plans for the National Tennis Center were coming together, the USTA board sought counsel from one of their own, Raleigh commercial real estate developer Andy Andrews. He is a former professional tennis player who in the early 1980s rose to number 37 in the world in doubles tennis and number 103 in singles before a hand injury ended his pro tennis career. For the past 20 years, Andrews has been involved in the financing and construction of more than $2.5 billion in office and multifamily development, both as president and CEO of Dominion Realty Partners and as a former top executive at Daniel Corporation. In the Triangle, his competitors are keeping an eye on his projects. In June, he opened the first speculative office building built in Raleigh in over a decade and the first office tower in downtown Raleigh in more than 7 years with the 11-story, $63 million Charter Square building on Fayetteville Street. Interestingly, for almost a decade during the turn of the century, Andrews did very little in the Triangle market. That was the time he spent enriching modern living in Richmond, Virginia. But now Andrews once again has set his eyes on the Triangle. With hundreds of millions in backing from Prudential's real estate arm in New York, Andrews is inching his way to force a change in downtown Raleigh's skyline, and the community is paying attention. A rocky road. For Andrews, supporting tennis is a nice distraction from the rigors of commercial development. He survived the toils of the economic recession that threatened to financially derail all of his building projects, and more recently, wrestled with grief after three construction workers died in a construction accident last spring at one of his buildings in downtown Raleigh. In 2007 and 2008, Andrews' company had more than 600 residential condo units under development, among those a joint venture partnership with Highwoods Properties to build 139 condo units atop the 33-story PNC Plaza Tower in downtown Raleigh and a 129,000-square-foot office building for Genworth Financial in North Raleigh. By the time of the 2008 recession hit, more than half of the buyer commitments he had for the condos had canceled their contracts, and Genworth's stock price, which had been at $23 per share when the lease was signed, had degraded to around 85 cents per share. At PNC Plaza, Dominion had started out with a 25% interest in the condo development. That dropped to 14% in 2009 and 7% in 2010 before Highwoods paid Dominion $500,000 to close out the deal with 24 condos still unsold. A lot of that was out of our control, Andrew says, but we never defaulted on the loan and we never filed for bankruptcy. During the recession, news was not getting any better for Andrews. In 2010, while at an airport headed to a golf tournament with his son, they got the news that his then 22-year-old daughter, Ryan, had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer. The cancer and her treatments at Duke Cancer Center have been tough on the family, he says, but she's tough as nails. Now they spend more time together as a family. In July, Andrews took Ryan and the rest of the family to Wimbledon in London, a tournament that Andrews hadn't been to since he had played there in the 1980s, and an event that's been on Ryan's bucket list. Ryan's been going to the U.S. Open with me for 23 years in a row, so this was something special, he says. Rise to tennis fame. Andrews was about 9 when his parents divorced and signed him up for tennis lessons with a part-time tennis pro at Carolina Country Club. The then coach of the men's tennis team at NC State University, J.W. Eisenhower. Eisenhower, now retired from NCSU, but still teaching tennis in Gaston County, remembers worrying that Andrews wouldn't be able to keep up with his tennis when he was sent away to Woodbury Forest School, the private boarding school in Virginia that his father, the late Alex Andrews, had also attended. But he had a good coach up there, and he did well up there, Eisenhower says. Andrews was offered scholarships to play tennis at several schools, and his first choice was UNC Chapel Hill, where 4 generations of his family had also attended. Andrews was offered a spot on the team, but when he made the trip to Chapel Hill to sign his commitment letter, Coach Don Skakel told him that he'd changed his mind and could promise Andrews only a 7th spot on a team of 8 players. Usually only the top 6 players on the team get tournament play. I was too proud to cry in front of Coach Skakel, and I didn't know what I was going to do, Andrews says. I was too embarrassed to call my parents. So he called his old coach from Raleigh. Eisenhower had 1 spot left on his team at NC State, and Andrews took it. I called my dad to tell him I'd signed with State, and he told me, "Well, we'll get that straight," he says. They didn't speak for 6 months. But at Andrews' first tournament versus UNC Chapel Hill, Eisenhower spotted a silver-haired man wearing a red sport coat who he recognized as Andrews' father, the retired brigadier general, pilot, and World War II war hero. "He told me he'd only wear it for my matches," Andrews says in reference to the NC State red jacket his father was wearing that day. There was no "I'm sorry" or anything like that. NC State in 1978 and 1979 won the ACC championship in men's tennis for the first and only times in school history. "We had a good team already," Eisenhower says, "but I think everybody would tell you that Andy was the cog we were missing to push us over the top. And he never lost a match to Carolina. That's not a bad thing to have when you are the coach at NC State." Andrew's father, a well-known Raleigh businessman who had helped start more than a dozen companies, including the former business telecom giant BTI, was also none too pleased when Andy decided to pursue being a tennis professional instead of going to law school or into business as the generation of Andrew's men had done before him. They made a deal. Andy had 2 years to break into the top 100 ranked players in the world. He reached it in 10 months. In 2013, Andrews was asked to join the board of directors of the USTA, the national governing body for the sport of tennis, with 720,000 members and an annual budget of more than $250 million. In January, he was nominated to serve a 2-year term as first vice president, an appointment that's traditionally next in line to become chairman, CEO, and president, and a role that many assume Andrews will be nominated for in 2017. Andy's passion for tennis and business is an invaluable asset for the USTA, especially as we are now in the midst of a historic transformation of the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, says Katrina Adams, USTA chairman of the board and president. Andy is a great partner in this, someone who brings insight and creative thinking to the challenges of growing the sport on all levels. Real estate calling. After injuring his hand during an international tour, Andrews decided to leave professional tennis and return to Raleigh. He and his wife Carol, a native of Henderson who was working as a stockbroker for Merrill Lynch, married in 1987. A few years later, both his father and mother developed Alzheimer's disease, and he was able to help, along with his siblings, to make sure they were properly cared for in their final years. He reconnected with a childhood friend, Raleigh business leader Greg Poole III, who is godfather to both Andrews' children. Poole says he's never dared set foot on a tennis court with his friend. "He's a highly competitive individual who doesn't like to lose, but he's not opportunistic as to hurt others or to be self-serving," Poole says. "In fact, he oftentimes looks for ways to give back in some manner." After his return, Andrews wasn't sure what to do, but got a job leasing office buildings that were once owned and managed by Birmingham-based Daniel Corporation, a company that had acquired some land in Raleigh from his father. One of my favorite things to do when we were on tour in some of these other countries was to go up in buildings, Andrews remembers. There were no English movies, no English restaurants. There was nothing to do, so I'd go out and see all these cool buildings in Tokyo and Beijing and all over the place. At Daniel Corporation, Andrews learned the business of real estate development, establishing relationships with decision makers at Prudential Real Estate Investors, Medical Mutual Group, and other investors in real estate who would follow him when he split from Daniel Corporation in 2005 to start his own company. Michael Campbell, Andrews' partner at Dominion's office in Richmond, Virginia, says there were several leadership changes happening at Daniel Corporation at the time that made it easier to cut the cord. We were both ready for a change and to go out on our own, and that was a logical time to do that, Campbell says. And while during the economic downturn and recovery, Dominion did have to lower prices and make concessions to buyers, tenants, and their financial partners, they never lost money on any of their development projects, Campbell says. We got really lucky, Andrew says. We had heavy partners that didn't go under. We've done 16 deals with Prudential, and there's a lot of trust there. Eyes on the future. Among one of his biggest deals with Prudential has been the construction of the $63 million 11-story Charter Square office building that opened in June on Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh. But to date, the building is only about 58% occupied, and Andrew says he wants more stability from the building's rent roll before breaking ground on his next big project downtown, the 22-story sister building at Charter Square North. Prudential is also expected to be an equity partner in the second Charter Square building, which will have a mix of office, multifamily, and retail spaces. He's given no timeline for when construction could start. Construction will be wrapping up in August on a 105,000-square-foot office building in West Raleigh called Wade 3, while plans are underway for a fourth and fifth office building at Wade. The firm will also be breaking ground soon on a multifamily project in Richmond and building a 300-unit apartment community near Gateway Village in Uptown Charlotte. And come August 2016, when the new retractable roof of Arthur Ashe Stadium is working, Andrews is sure to have a front row seat. And with this article, there's also a section called Trivial Pursuit, the Andy Andrews edition. Won the North Carolina High School State Championship in singles as a freshman at Raleigh's Ravenscroft School, the youngest player to do so. His father, Alex Andrews, a retired Brigadier General in the Air Force Reserves, was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross and Air Medal following a mission over France that crippled the B-17 bomber he was piloting during World War II. Alex Andrews' exploits in World War II inspired the novel by John Hersey, The War Love, and the 1962 movie by the same name that starred Steve McQueen. Developed the first LEED Gold-certified office building in Raleigh, the six-story Genworth building on Six Forks Road. Was adopted by his parents when he was 2 weeks old. Inducted into the North Carolina Tennis Association's Hall of Fame in 2003 and the George Whitfield Hall of Fame in 2012. The town of Andrews in North Carolina Mountains in the North Carolina Mountains was named after his great-grandfather, Alex B. Andrews, who helped build railroad lines across western North Carolina. Twice named All-American and won five ACC individual titles at NC State University in men's tennis. The indoor courts at the J.W. Eisenhower Tennis Center at NC State are named in Andrews' honor. Reached finals of the Australian Open and the semifinals of the U.S. Open with fellow NC Tennis Hall of Fame member John Sadry in 1983. Son Beau Andrews is touring on the eGolf Gateway Tour after making the All-ACC team in golf while at Georgia Tech. In his first appearance at the U.S. Open in 1981, Andrews lost to Yannick Noah, who was ranked 13th in the world, in five sets. And has helped raise more than $9 million for tennis programs, facilities, and opportunities around the South. And the source, Of the information was the North Carolina Tennis Foundation, TBJ Interviews with Andrews and colleagues. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Backhoe skills flourish at NCDOT's rodeo. It's not often you get to see an industrial backhoe gingerly moving ping pong balls across a sweltering parking lot, but that was just one of the skills 84 North Carolina Department of Transportation workers showed off during this year's rodeo competition, spelled R-O-A-D-E-O. NCDOT equipment operators from across the state competed in six events at the state fairgrounds in Raleigh on July 21. Competitors were judged on how well they operated the equipment in maneuvering around obstacles, backing into enclosed locations, locating safety defects, and other challenges. This is a great chance for our people to demonstrate the skills it takes to deliver safe roads for the citizens of North Carolina, says Nick Tennyson, NCDOT Chief Deputy Secretary. This year's winners hailed from NCDOT's Division 4, which represents Edgecombe, Halifax, Johnston, Nash, Wayne, and Wilson counties. The winners will represent North Carolina in the Southeastern Regional Competition in Myrtle Beach on September 14. Magazine, Campbell Law is underrated. Ignore Campbell University at your peril. That's the advice of Bloomberg Business, which touts the law school in downtown Raleigh as the most underrated law school in the nation. Many ranking organizations have long taken note of Triangle area law schools. Duke University ranks 8th and UNC Chapel Hill 34th by U.S. News & World Report, for example. But Campbell typically ranks a bit down the line. U.S. News doesn't even give a number rank for Campbell. However, Campbell's Norman Adrian Wiggins School of Law deserves better, according to new research. Somewhat ironically, Bloomberg's report comes from research by Alfred L. Brophy, a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. According to Brophy, some of the traditional rankings put emphasis on the wrong metrics. Brophy's research measures student quality based on median LSAT scores of first-year students, employment data for the graduating class, and citations to each school's primary law review from 2007 through 2014. Using the LSAT and employment variables, Brophy determined a new ranking. Campbell does not rank at the top of the list. In fact, it ranks number 112. However, Campbell does rank as the law school with the most disparate score from that given by U.S. News, from which Bloomberg deduced the most underrated moniker. Durham Chef preps picnic for launch. RX Wine Lab, a wine bar and educational service located in Durham, hosted a pop-up dinner July 16 at 610 Glenwood Avenue, along with barbecue caterer Wyatt Dixon and chef Ben Adams. Titled Pink Bubbles and Pig, this three-course meal featured the talents of Dixon and Adams, who will launch their new restaurant later this year in Durham, named Picnic. RX Wine Lab was on hand to pour rosé-style wine with each dish served. Some of the items crafted that night featured North Carolina blue crab beignets, Calvander mac and cheese, chilled cucumber gazpacho, North Carolina field pea salad, all to accompany a whole hog barbecue topped with Wyatt's pig whistle sauce. RX Wine Lab's master sommelier, Fred Dex, mentioned that the location on 610 Glenwood looked rather inviting, and he might have some interest in opening a wine-themed restaurant there in the future. And in a section called The Hype, Triangle Cities make headlines in recent national rankings. Number 7, Durham is the 7th best city to be a driver, according to WalletHub. Number 9, Durham is 9th among top 10 cities for creatives, according to Smart Asset. And number 10, Raleigh is 10th best city to be a driver, according to WalletHub. And in the You Said It section, reader Facebook comments to story, Charlotte said to be among possibilities for MLB expansion. I believe they should demo Dorothea Dix and put an MLB there. Matthew Clary. Isn't it, at least to an extent, a catch-22? We don't have the income base, so we don't have a team, so we don't have the income base sponsors. Michael Teal. Woot! Fingers crossed. Hashtag positive baseball vibes. Katie Henry. QC hashtag MLB hashtag baby. Antonio Taylor. And finally, in bidding adieu, longtime CFO Charlie Peters' retirement became official at Red Hat Tower, and Biz was told it was a party. Last December, the 63-year-old Peters announced his retirement after 11 years at the company. The basketball player turned finance exec is being replaced by Cisco veteran Frank Calderoni. And the headline on the first full-length news story in the Triangle Business Journal: Duke Energy picks Raleigh exec to head North Carolina operations. Duke Energy has picked its North Carolina leader for when outgoing state president Paul Newton retires later this year. David Fountain, the company's senior vice president of enterprise legal support, who works out of Duke's Raleigh office, will step into the role September 1. Fountain will be responsible for advancing the company's regulatory initiatives while managing state and local regulatory and governmental relations, economic development, community affairs, water strategy, hydroelectric licensing, and lake services. We're seeing major technological developments in renewable energy and in battery storage, Fountain says. We're also seeing customer expectations evolve. They want more convenience and more control. We want to meet those expectations. Lloyd Yates, Executive Vice President of Market Solutions and President of Duke Energy's Carolinas region, says Fountain's decades of experience will serve him well as the company's top executive in North Carolina. More than 3.2 million customers across North Carolina depend on us. David understands that responsibility, Yates says. Fountain says over the next month, he will be working with his team to ensure there is a smooth transition when Newton steps down. Paul has done a great job, as have the individuals who precede him, Fountain says. They really work to serve our customers. That's something that's woven into the fabric of the company. I look forward to continuing the work they started. Fountain joined Carolina Power and Light in Raleigh in 2000 as an associate general counsel. In that role, he provided counsel during the company's merger with Florida Progress Corporation, which formed Progress Energy. He was promoted to Deputy General Counsel for Commercial Transactions in 2003 and to General Counsel for Corporate Services in 2008. Fountain served as Vice President of Progress Energy's Legal Department from 2009 until the close of the merger between Duke Energy and Progress Energy in July 2012, when he assumed his current role. Fountain has also worked as an attorney at Smith Helms, Mullis & Moore, a predecessor firm to McGuire Woods LLP in Charlotte. He also has deep ties to UNC Chapel Hill, having earned a law degree, an MBA, and a bachelor's degree from the university. Fountain's predecessor, Newton, announced his intent to retire in late June. Under Newton, Duke structured a response to a massive coal ash spill last year from a steam station into the Dan River near Eden in Rockingham County. In May, Duke agreed to pay $102 million in fines after pleading guilty to all charges related to the spill. The fine included $68 million in criminal penalties and an additional $34 million, which will go to environmental projects and conservation efforts benefiting rivers and wetlands in North Carolina and Virginia. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. Old Greyhound bus terminal to be torn down, new apartment building planned. A key piece of property in downtown Raleigh's Glenwood South District is getting developer interest from the same apartment firm that's building the Lincoln Apartments near Moore Square. Banner Company Apartments, LLC, has a site plan with the city to build up to 270,000 square feet of multifamily building space on the 1.8-acre site that was formerly a Greyhound bus terminal at 314 West Jones Street. A representative of Raleigh's City Planning Department says the six-story building is expected to house 250 apartment units on the corner of Harrington and Lane Streets. Greyhound had in 2013 relocated its Raleigh bus terminal to a newly renovated terminal building north of downtown at 2210 Capitol Boulevard. The Jones Street site had been Greyhound Lines Incorporated's Raleigh bus terminal stop for more than 40 years. Banner Apartments is expected to open the first units at The Lincoln, the company's first apartment project in downtown Raleigh, in August. Nine more restaurants coming to White Oak. Following the spring opening of the giant new Cabela's outdoor store in Garner, the outparcels and vacant retail spots surrounding it at the White Oak Shopping Center in US 70 are exploding with new food and drink options. Here's a list of the new eateries that have opened or are expected to open in the coming months. City Barbecue opened in June. Starbucks Coffee Shop opened in late June. Carolina Ale House opened July 20. Five Guys Burgers and Fries opened July 20. Longhorn Steakhouse is under construction. Buffalo Brothers is under construction. Red Robin has submitted plans with the town for a new restaurant building. Panera Bread has submitted plans with the town for a new deli and bakery. And Crafty Burgers and Brews will be moving into a space next to White Oak Cinemas that was recently vacated by Shuckum Shack. Hillsborough Street Tract fetches $3.1 million offer. Raleigh development firm The Lundy Group has offered to pay the city of Raleigh nearly $3.1 million for a 1.18-acre site across from Campbell University's Law School on Hillsborough Street. But Lundy is likely to get some competition before that deal is finalized. Under the state's fee for title upset bid process, the offer must be advertised for at least 10 days to allow for potential bidders with higher offers to submit their proposals, says James Sauls, economic development manager for the city. If any sealed bids are received in that 10-day period, we'll review them. If there's an upset bid, we'll advertise for another 10 days. It will continue until there's no more upset bids received, Sauls says. The tax value of the combined sites, which take up about half of the city block bordered by Hillsborough, Dawson, and Morgan Streets, is about $2.4 million. A recent rezoning of the property is expected to allow for the construction of a commercial and mixed-use building of up to 20 stories in height. After 25 years, Orleans Homes bids adieu to the Triangle Charlotte markets. Taylor Morrison Home Corporation, an Arizona home building company that's been expanding eastward, has acquired the two Orleans Homes division offices in Raleigh and Charlotte, plus Orleans assets in Chicago, in a deal valued at $166 million. Orleans Homes is a Pennsylvania home builder that's been active in the Triangle market for 25 years as Parker and Orleans Home Builders Incorporated. It owns about 200 home lots in five communities in Wake County, including in Apex, Cary, and Wake Forest, where it is building homes priced from $190,000 to the high $300,000. The acquired businesses will transition to the Taylor Morrison brand over the next few months. Taylor Morrison is led by Cheryl Palmer, the company's president and CEO since its merger of Taylor Woodrow and Morrison Homes. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page, written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, UNC's hospice housework starts in Chatham County. UNC Healthcare broke ground on a new hospice house in Chatham County. It will become the second building in the massive Chatham Park project and the first inpatient hospice facility in the county. Called the CQ, Jim and Betsy Bryan Hospice Home of UNC Healthcare in Chatham County. The facility has a budget of $4.7 million, and the State Employees Credit Union, CQ, Foundation committed $1 million for its completion. Scheduled to open in 2016, the new home will serve area patients and their families, providing end-of-life care. It is named after recently retired UNC School of Medicine faculty member Dr. Jim Bryan and his wife Betsy. This will become the only inpatient hospice facility in either Chatham or Orange counties. Durham and Johnston counties each have 12 licensed beds, and Wake has 14 licensed beds. These are only inpatient level services and do not include nursing homes or home care services. In Chatham County last year, 264 patients received 24,298 days of care, but those were provided in the patients' homes. Most Chatham Hospice patients are served by the UNC Hospice or Community Home Care and Hospice. Last year, those two facilities combined to serve 2/3 of all patients and nearly 3/4 of all patient days, according to records with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Chatham had a death rate of 9.3 deaths per 1,000 residents from 2009 through 2013, lower than many rural counties, but higher than more urban counties. According to the hospice licensure law, as passed by the North Carolina General Assembly in 1984, a hospice must provide home care services to terminally ill patients with a life expectancy generally not to exceed 6 months. In the spring of 2015, there were 247 hospice facilities across the state. Last year, 40,787 hospice patients received care. Hospitals applaud McCrory's Mental Health Task Force plan. Hospital executives know all too well the toll that mental and behavioral health patients can have on their health systems. These patients can show up in emergency departments and sometimes stay for days, clogging the rooms and halls of an ED, and in rare cases, even becoming dangerous to hospital staff or other patients. Community hospitals are the safety net for behavioral health. Every 3 minutes, a North Carolinian experiencing a behavioral health crisis arrives at a hospital emergency department, according to the North Carolina Hospital Association. Not only are these visits and admissions expensive, but they are not providing the appropriate level of care for the patients. That is an average of 186 patients per day. ED visits are expensive, about $1,500 on average. In 2013, North Carolina hospitals had 162,000 behavioral health emergency department visits and 68,000 admissions. Not only are these visits and admissions expensive, they are not providing the appropriate care for patients, according to NCHA. In an effort to improve care, Governor Pat McCrory announced intentions to establish a North Carolina Mental Health and Substance Use Task Force, a panel that will make recommendations to improve the lives of those with mental illness and substance use disorders. Our goal is to improve collaboration between healthcare, justice, and safety professionals using existing resources, McCrory said. If we improve these linkages, we offer the best hand up to those in need, especially our young people. The task force has the support from hospitals. North Carolina hospitals are pleased that Governor McCrory has made mental health and substance use issues a priority in his administration, according to the NCHA. We look forward to working collaborative with the task force in developing and implementing workable strategies to address this critical health issue. Duke bests all others in hospital rankings. Duke University Hospital ranks first and UNC Hospitals third in North Carolina in the latest hospital rankings released by U.S. News & World Report. Duke also placed 14th on the National Honor Roll with six specialties worthy of note, according to U.S. News. Those specialties include cardiology and heart surgery, pulmonology, ophthalmology, urology, rheumatology, and nephrology. The publication determines the rankings based on survival data, which makes up 32.5% of the final score, reputation with specialists, which makes up 27.5%, and patient safety and other care-related indicators, like staffing and patient volume, which makes up the final 40%. And finally, Only two North Carolina agencies receive five-star seal. The federal government for the first time released star ratings on home health agencies, and North Carolina has a lower percentage of highly rated home health agencies than the national average, and lower than all but one of its neighboring states. Only two agencies out of 172 rated in the state received a five-star rating, one in Charlotte and one in Wilmington. In North Carolina, 18% received a rating of four stars or five stars. All states averaged 26% of agencies that rated that highly, and only Georgia had a lower percentage of North Carolina's neighboring states. And for those star ratings, only three were above the four stars. Well Care Home Health in Raleigh, 4.5 stars. Biata Nurses, Raleigh, 4.5 stars. And Innovative Senior Care Home Health, Durham, 4 stars. And now we turn to the On Technology page in the Triangle Business Journal, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, RST Fibers Fall from Grace. Town Government Look for Ways to Mitigate Mess. Shelby-based internet provider RST Fiber broke a lot of hearts in Wake Forest in July. That's when the town stopped waiting on the company to act on a promise to bring high-speed fiber internet service to Wake Forest and formally severed the relationship with RST, leaving residents in fiber limbo. RST never answered our calls, says Deputy Town Manager Roe O'Donnell, who is scrambling to find another wireless player to fill the gap. And it's a struggle, as those who have already promised to bring fiber to the Triangle, including Google Fiber, and a player already here, AT&T, have no immediate plans for Wake Forest. CenturyLink is offering rural service in the area, but only to certain neighborhoods. RST had promised to bring fiber internet to the Triangle in as few as 60 days when it sent out its first press announcements in March 2014. Delay after delay hit, and just after the Christmas season, executives stopped returning O'Donnell's phone calls. And in the meantime, they'd packed up their equipment and vanished, despite installing fiber lines at several Wake Forest residences. And Wake Forest isn't the only town left in the lurch by RST Fiber. The company is the subject of two complaints to Attorney General Roy Cooper's office, including one by a church. Charlotte-based World Worship Church uses internet to live stream services as well as for other business functions, but on June 20, its RST fiber service cut off unexpectedly. We have made numerous attempts via phone and left voicemail messages, but have gotten no response from them, the complaint reads. It's a common complaint. Nobody will call you back, Shelby resident Joe Getzinger cites in his complaint, after his RST service was cut off without warning. Many people are having the same issue. Getzinger, via his complaint filed in June, is seeking credit for days without internet as well as a resolution to the blackout. A spokesperson for the North Carolina Department of Justice says RST Fiber has not responded to its inquiry. And, unlike customers in Shelby, those 2,500 residents that signed up for the service in Wake Forest had yet to pay any money, says O'Donnell. In addition to multiple delays and communication blackouts with RST, there were warning signs that implementation was not going as smoothly as RST CEO Dan Limerick had predicted. RST Fiber hinted at difficulties on Twitter, first tweeting about minor struggles last October. Sorry for delays, we wish we had a purse like AT&T, the company tweeted in November. Even if all we do is help make the big guys give people better options, we accomplish something, the company tweeted in December. The last tweet from the @RST Fiber account was sent in January. We are working every day to make things happen. Unfortunately, no movement or any developments are planned at this time. Stay tuned. Multiple calls to both RST Fiber and Limerick have not been returned. Windsor Circle grows with new space in Durham. Windsor Circle is making big moves, literally, as it preps for a new space in the Bull City. The Durham marketing software company, the brainchild of a group of Bronto veterans, including CEO Matt Williamson, was a 12-person operation when it moved to American Underground's At Main Campus in downtown Durham. It was so small that Williamson says an early effort was made to divide its suite so that another company could sublet. But growth happened quickly. In addition to its main office suite, about 2,000 square feet, the company has spiraled out into other offices at AU. With the move, all 75 of its employees will be in one big space, all at the same time, on two floors of yet-to-be-disclosed building in downtown Durham, in nearly 14,000 square feet of space. And the team is still growing. Already there are 15 openings with more to follow. Williamson says he will miss the entrepreneurship community of AU, where each trip to the break room is a potential networking conversation. When asked if it is time for an initial public offering, Williamson said, "I don't think so, not in the near term. I think ultimately, IPOs are great vehicles for companies when they have hit a really solid level of maturity and growth." Williamson adds, "I feel like we've made a lot of fantastic traction and a lot of growth, but we're still pretty early in the trajectory. And under a section called Jobs, Silicon Valley shop picks Raleigh for new ops. Silicon Valley-based Guidebook is bringing up to 20 jobs to its downtown Raleigh office, thanks in part to a $10 million investment. A lot of it has to do with East Coast customers, Jim Gresham, senior account executive, says of the growth. "Until the Raleigh office was opened, all of our office hours were obviously Pacific time, out of Silicon Valley. Moving to the East Coast gives us a lot of opportunities to provide early support to the customers on the East Coast." The company develops apps for events, conventions, and campus tours. And finally, in the They Said It section, "I didn't want other people from Indy jumping ship and leaving for this new startup." And that's from Don Brown, CEO of Indianapolis-based Interactive Intelligence, a call center technology company that just pledged to bring 200 jobs to Durham. The company entered the Triangle last year after buying OrgSpan, and it is already hiring for the new positions, which carry an average annual salary of $70,000. This was a little bit out of the norm for us, and that's Vanessa Harrison, president of AT&T North Carolina, of the decision to expand fiber internet service to Durham, an area out of the typical AT&T coverage area. It's part of the fulfillment of a promise the company made to the university-driven initiative, North Carolina Next Generation Network, last year. And now we turn to the On Transportation page, written by Jeff Jeffrey. The main headline: NCDOT offers good news, bad news for Triangle commuters impacted by Fortify project. The North Carolina Department of Transportation has good news and bad news for Triangle drivers with regard to the ongoing Fortify construction project. The good news: construction work on the I-440 portion of the project is now complete, and the highway will soon be back to full capacity. The bad news: the project is preparing to shift focus to the next stage of work on I-40, which will involve additional lane closures and further delays for commuters. The final phase of the I-440 work was finished July 17. Construction crews were able to reopen the rest of the I-495 US 64-264 West ramp to I-440 East. A portion of one of the lanes on the ramp has been closed for some time, which has caused minor delays for drivers traveling toward Raleigh from the direction of Knightdale. "We have been reopening it piece by piece for the past few weeks," says NCDOT spokesman Steve Abbott. Abbott says the ramp's reopening marks the end of Fortify-related roadwork on I-440. With that finished, crews can soon begin working in earnest on the next stage of the I-40 part of the Fortify project. Just a few days ago, crews began shifting lanes on I-40 East between Lake Wheeler Road and Saunders Street. The lane shifts will eventually bring I-40 in both directions down to three lanes for the entire 8.5-mile stretch of I-40 from Cary to the I-40-440 split. The lane closures will remain in place for the next year as road crews work to repair the interstate and make improvements. NCDOT has been warning drivers for months that they should add 30 minutes to their commute if they plan on traveling through the affected section of I-40. Abbott says many drivers may want to find alternate routes to work or to discuss additional options with their employers. Employees may want to consider telecommuting or flexible schedules to make things easier on their employees, Abbott says, but that may not be an option for all employees. Banning lefts may be right solution to weekend traffic problem. Getting home from bars in downtown Raleigh on the weekends may get a little easier under a plan presented to city officials July 21. The key to the plan? Left turns. Raleigh City Council is considering whether to implement a six-month pilot program that would prevent drivers from making left turns on portions of Fayetteville Street and Glenwood Avenue from Friday to Sunday between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m. Mike Kennan, Raleigh's manager of transportation operations, says weekend crowds can make it difficult for taxi cabs and ride-hailing services like Uber and Lyft to get through some areas of downtown. Add in drivers waiting to make a left turn, and traffic can grind to a halt, Kennan says. The restrictions would apply to left turns from Fayetteville Street between Harget and Davie Streets and from Glenwood Avenue between Johnson and Jones Street. Left turns are notorious for backing up traffic, Kennan says. We have been brainstorming ways to move the traffic more quickly, and this was an idea that seemed like a low-cost way to do that. City officials will track how blocking left turns at key locations affects traffic flow. Officials plan to reach out to business owners in the area, taxi drivers, and bar patrons to see if they noticed a difference. Kennan says findings of that study would be presented to City Council with a recommendation on whether or not to keep the restrictions in place. Entertainment is important to downtown Raleigh, Kennan says. We're hoping this is a win-win for drivers, owners, and patrons that improve service for everyone. And in a He Said It section, we knew we'd see an effect on the Triangle Counties, but we found that the impact stretched all the way from here to Charlotte and to the Triad. And that's Caleb Miles, President and CEO of the Pinehurst Area's Convention and Visitors Bureau, on the economic impact of the 2014 U.S. Open Golf Championships. Pinehurst Resort and Country Club will host the men's tournament for the fourth time in 2024. And finally, by the numbers, North Carolina scored big in venture capital investments during the second quarter. According to the latest Money Tree report from PricewaterhouseCoopers LLP and the National Venture Capital Association, $118 million amount venture capitalists invested in North Carolina during the second quarter, $32 million amount of VC investment 1 year ago, 15. The number of VC deals in North Carolina, which marked an increase over the 12 reported during the first quarter and 10 from 1 year ago. And 14, North Carolina's rank for quarter two VC investments, putting the state between Maryland and Connecticut, respectively. And now we turn to the A Better World page written by Todd Cohen. Todd Cohen publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline on his column, Bridges to Healthier Communities. This spring, the town of Zebulon opened a farmer's market to help increase access to food for people in need. And the city of Raleigh is working with the Wake County Public School System on an agreement to let residents in neighborhoods with no space for outdoor recreation use outdoor play areas at two elementary schools. Both projects are part of a $1.97 million initiative the John Rex Endowment is funding in six Wake County municipalities to boost healthy eating and active living, particularly among vulnerable families and children. In a separate national initiative, the New Jersey-based Robert Wood Johnson Foundation invested $34 million over 5 years in 49 U.S. communities to improve access to healthy food and physical activity, mainly for children in low-income communities. Playing a key role in both funding initiatives has been Active Living by Design, or ALBD, a Chapel Hill-based project of Third Sector New England. ALBD provides consulting and technical assistance to create healthier communities and works to help community partnerships create environments that promote healthy eating and active living. Sarah Strunk, executive director of ALBD, says its work is based on the idea that people are likely to make healthier choices not simply as a result of efforts to educate them and shape their behavior, but by also by changing policies, social settings, and physical environments that affect health. Formed in 2002 as a national program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and housed for 12 years at UNC Chapel Hill, ALBD operates with an annual budget of $2.2 million, all of it from grants and contracts, and staff of 11. Much of its work supports foundations directly, helping them develop initiatives to reduce child obesity, increase physical activity, reduce incidence of chronic diseases, or improve community safety. ALBD also provides technical assistance, coaching, consulting, and supportive learning by groups that are part of local collaboratives supported by foundations and other funders. For the John Rex Endowment Initiative, ALBD identified and assessed local efforts in Wake County, helped design the grant program, and is providing technical assistance to the six municipalities the endowment funded. For the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Initiative, ALBD helped develop and is running the program and providing technical support to grantees. We connect people who are interested in making their community better with those who are willing to invest in that work, says Rissa Wilkerson, Associate Executive Director of ALBD, and also with other resources in other communities who are doing the work and with other national organizations. ALBD, which has counted on the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for most of its funding, also is working to diversify its funding base, and it is expanding its definition of health to include all of the factors that influence where people live, work, and play, such as crime and safety, transportation, housing, clinical care, and medical care, Strunk says. And in nonprofit news, campaign targets poverty in Raleigh. Building a Stronger Raleigh Together, a partnership between Passage Home and the J.D. Lewis Multipurpose Center, kicked off its campaign to raise $250,000 in 2015 in an effort to break the cycle of poverty in Southeast Raleigh through access to stable housing, healthy food, education, employment, and opportunity. Leaders in that effort chatted with newly signed San Antonio Spurs forward David West at City Restaurant in downtown Raleigh to rally support for the movement and for their upcoming major campaign fundraiser, August 1. BCBSNC wants to mark up playgrounds. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina is accepting grant applications to introduce playprints to playgrounds. Playprints are ground markings or colorful shapes and games that are painted on existing pavement. Research shows that children who visit play spaces with ground markings take part in more physical activity than children at unmarked playgrounds. Grant applications are accepted through August 6. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Improving Bottom Line as Top Line Shrinks. The headline pretty much tells the story. I've been following the second quarter earnings release pretty closely in the past week, and from the release numbers, companies are missing their revenue targets, but they continue to manage to squeeze out earnings growth. Do more with less, the mantra corporations embraced during the Great Recession, seems to be still in play. In the past few days, some of the biggest tech giants in the world, such as IBM, Apple, Yahoo, Microsoft, and Google, announced a mixed bag of financial results. Nestled in the numbers were massive restructuring charges, currency fluctuations impact, and slow sales. Is this something we should be worried about if we are a small and mid-sized business that works as vendors of these large corporations? To get the answers, I would urge you to look into transcripts of the earnings conference calls and read between the lines of CEO speak. Padding recurring revenue is becoming a bigger problem with every quarter. Companies are finding it hard to build upon a sustainable revenue base, and that's because of the competition and pricing. And then there is China. The full effect of China's slowing economy likely will show up in the third quarter numbers. Almost every market analyst during Q calls honed down on a firm's top-line growth and forecast pattern going forward. Where are the new markets? How are you going to grow sales with your existing product lines? What is your cost of sales? All that may be bad news for employees. For example, IBM likes to use the word rebalance when it states workforce restructuring. That really means the company is shedding jobs. It is true, however, that Big Blue is getting into new services, and for that, it needs workers with a different set of skills. In that regard, yes, IBM will hire workers as well. But the changing landscape of Wall Street expectations, coupled with an eroding top-line growth, will soon create a new crop of winners and losers in corporate America. Expect more companies to merge, more layoffs, and the rise of mega companies in select industries. Already, the Federal Reserve has started to throw out signs that a rate increase is coming in September. To me, after looking at these quarterly revenue reports, I'm not sure that's the right call. All that may become apparent for the Fed as we head deeper into this earnings season. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.